You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So how have you guys been doing?
Well, I'm sick because of you.
Yeah.
other than that, I'm fine. Steve and I were working together in the SGU studio, and I definitely caught illness from Steve.
Well, you caught it.
Ooh, bunker.
And I coughed on you, mm-hmm. But let's not assume causation from correlation or postdoc ergo propter hoc, Jay. You could have caught that virus from anyone. Who knows?
That's true.
That's
but
right.
But I caught it from you.
Yeah, that's the narrative that you wish to support, then fine.
It's likely that I did get it from you, Steve, since
we
were like touching a million things. We actually were putting together a stainless steel desk, like a workshop desk. Oh my God, there was a little bolt that we had to put on the inside of a drawer that Steve spent an hour on. One nut. It took us an hour to figure out.
Two nuts working on one nut.
Was it stripped? Did you do it? Did you have a problem with
design.
Order of operations?
Just bad.
Are you sure you didn't read the directions? And
the directions were horrible.
The directions were a picture with a bolt and the arrow to where it went.
That was it. No, it was all a design issue.
What more do you need?
But we were actually starting to get pissed off, and then we went to Home Depot and bought like a really small, you know, wrench. You know how like there's a wrench that has like the U-shaped wrench on one end, and on the other end it has the circle that the nut will fit
like
into?
The ratchet. Yeah.
The ratchet end. We had to get a really, really skinny version of that, and it kind of worked.
Actually, the thing that worked was we got a regular nut that was bigger that you could actually hold in your two fingers and manipulate into place. Because the thing is, you had so little space to work with, I couldn't get like my fingers in there with a nut in my fingers. And I kept dropping it because the nut itself was too small or something. I don't know. So anyway, it was fine. Once I got the new bigger nuts, it took me 2 minutes to get it on there.
Tell me about it.
You could waste so much time on this stupidest little engineering problem.
Yeah, we did all the big, heavy, hard stuff without a problem. You know, the things that you like actually don't want to do, like carry the stupid box that weighs like 800 pounds from the garage to the basement. But we're like literally at the end. We're like, we just got to put this on and we're done. And nope, that was an hour.
It's fine. You both caught a cold, so you're good.
And I was sick for the last week. I'm still sick. I had the same cold for the last week. And I've been traveling to two different lectures over the last week.
So you're getting people sick all over the country.
Yeah, probably. Like
Steve is patient zero with this
thing.
But I went to Oklahoma for the first time. Anybody here ever been to Oklahoma?
Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's right by Texas. No, I used to drive over the border to get cheeseburgers.
Texas, yeah.
I live super close.
It's a pretty state, very flat compared to Connecticut.
Oh, it's flat.
Yeah. People were very nice. It was in Oklahoma City, which is a very cosmopolitan area. Very mm-hmm. nice.
Sure
very
is.
Diverse. Mm-hmm. So whenever I go to other places, other regions, cities, countries, whatever, I like to ask the local skeptics, so what's the big mm-hmm. issue you guys confront here? You know, what's a big skeptical belief of the local population that you're dealing with? And they all said, like,
flat earth.
Unequivocally, no. Well, what do you think? What would be your guess?
Creationism.
Climate change, more mm-hmm. than creationism, more than anything else, because Oklahoma, again, this is now the consensus of opinion of these academics I was talking with in Oklahoma City. It's basically in the thrall of the fossil fuel industry.
Sure is.
Which is believable when you see the Capitol building and on the lawn of the state Capitol building is an oil rig. You know, there's a drill right there pumping
oil. Wow.
Nice.
There's a lot of fracking that goes on in Oklahoma, and they all were like, yeah, the mm-hmm. earthquakes are off the hook. There's like earthquakes all the time.
Whoa. You know, it's gotten out of control.
Oof. But what's interesting is the local economy, I mean, the state economy is dependent on the fossil fuel industry. And most of the people, either they work for the fossil fuel industry or they know somebody who does or somebody in their family does. So they're very defensive. So climate change, like, no, you'd even mention the words carbon and, you know, and then people have a meltdown. But so they said that the common belief in Oklahoma, because you can't deny the fact that there's all these earthquakes because you feel them and it's clearly a change.
Yeah.
So guess what they think? Guess what they blame on the earthquakes. What they blame the earthquakes on?
The devil,
fracking. Atheists,
fracking.
No, they say it's not. Can't
we know
fracking.
It's frack.
Nothing.
Oh, what they bad, do blame them? What they, right. Oh yeah, Satan. Yeah, yeah.
No, they blame it on wind turbines.
Oh, right. The vibrations. Well, what? Hey, you never know.
Because there's also Oklahoma is the state where the wind goes blowing down the planes, right? So it's very windy. Certainly, it's actually there's this. From what I hear, there's a steady wind blowing through the state. So they've been diversifying their energy portfolio with wind turbines, which makes sense. So there's like blog posts now, like basically, you know, saying, hey, this perfect example of correlation causation, you know, confusion.
Yeah.
Windmills have been increasing in the last few years and earthquakes have been increasing in the last few years. It's definitely the wind turbines.
But fracking's increased.
Yeah, but it can't be the fracking because we are dependent on oil. So
that gives us jobs.
So has the rate of condom purchases.
Yeah, so another thing I learned, it's not just that there's fracking going on, because there's fracking going on in other states as well. It's that Oklahoma allows for the disposal of wastewater, the injection of wastewater underground. And in fact, taking it from other states. Like they're taking Texas's wastewater and injecting it in Oklahoma. That's why Oklahoma is where all the earthquakes are happening.
What? Oh, so it's not the actual fracking, but it's the injecting of the
disposal
wastewater?
Yes, the disposal of wastewater. That's the big problem. I can't hear the word frack without thinking of this.
Frick?
No, the Cylons.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Battlestar Galactica.
Yep.
All right. So what do you do to work with this problem? I mean, eventually, it will continue to get it worse. It will not get better.
Yeah, the bottom line is that every time oil prices go down, like the state economy tanks, they just have to diversify their economy and be much less dependent on this one industry. And then maybe they could be a little bit more sane and like not inject other states' wastewater in their local system. So,
right.
Yeah, just their laws, their government, the state government is so friendly, to the fossil fuel industry that, crazy stuff like that happens.
Oh, boy.
So they need to diversify. Yeah, interesting. So that was I spent a few days in
Oklahoma.
It was very nice, though. Had a good time. I gave two talks on science-based medicine. Always interesting to gauge regular physicians, even academics out there in the world, and what do they think about it? It always amazes me that, like, I always ask, hey, anyone here ever hear of NRAs? No one. No one.
Whoa,
crickets.
No one?
None?
Nothing. Like to us, it's like this is a classic story of pathological science, and everyone has to know the story of NRAs. I mean, how could you not know that? Yeah. Nobody heard of it. Amazing.
Oh, boy.
So we have our work cut out for us.
Yeah. Suppose we do.
All right, Kara, get us started with what's the word.
Yeah, so the word this week was recommended by Krista Yancey from Fairbanks, Alaska. She's a listener of the show. She said, I came across a word in one of my philosophy of science courses that I think is important for all skeptics to know. And that word is teleology. Have you guys heard this word before?
No.
Oh, yeah.
I absolutely.
Absolutely. Do you know what it means?
Teleology is when the purpose of something causes the cause of the thing. So it reverses the cause and effect arrow.
Yes. So teleology
purpose drives reality. Yeah.
Exactly. It's the philosophical study of design and purpose in the natural world. And in this specific paradigm, explanations of phenomena focus on the purposes they serve instead of their postulated causes. Specifically, a fact or character of a particular natural phenomenon is teleologically described as being directed toward an end or shaped by a purpose. So obviously, this doctrine is problematic for a skeptical worldview. A clear example is that of evolution via natural selection. Fallaciously thinking of evolution as a guided process toward some end goal leads to a massive misunderstanding of its underlying mechanisms. And as Krista, who recommended the word, said in her email, quote, I'm immediately reminded of the news piece regarding dinosaur feathers and amber, where the understanding that feathers can facilitate flying in extant species may easily trap one into asking why dinosaurs were headed for flight, thereby forgetting all the other useful things that feathers did or may have done and dismissing the haphazard process that makes it so that feathers just happen to facilitate flying today. Wonderful. So insightful. Yeah. So here's the etymology of the word. Teleology itself was coined in 1728 by the German philosopher Baron Christian von Wolff, and it translates to the study of final causes. It comes from the modern Latin teleologia, which is rooted in the Greek teleos, meaning entire or complete. That's the possessive form of telos, meaning end or result. And, of course, the suffix, which we see on a lot of words, logia, which refers to a speaking, a discourse, a theory, or a science. So it is the kind of theory of the end or complete, or the end result. From the Blackwell Dictionary of Western Philosophy, here's a little bit more info on it. They said, quote, Aristotle assumed that everything that happens in the universe must be understood as the striving of something towards an end, promoting its well-being or helping it to survive. He ascribes telos to plants and animals, believing that their behavior serves their needs and preserves their life. In view of the regularity of the natural world, he claims that nature itself must have an internal end or purpose. Aristotle did not admit a conscious rational agent in his teleological explanation, but in the teleological argument or argument from design, the Christian tradition infers from the regularity in nature that there is a supernatural designer, God, who designed everything in the world to be of service to man. And so teleology really was explored in its earliest forms by Plato and Aristotle. They used the word telos, but they didn't, you know, call it a teleology. And then after that, Immanuel Kant wrote about it often, William Paley, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, and many other philosophers. But it was, of course, rejected by Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, and many others. But I think we most often associate it with Aristotle.
Yeah, it's a critical concept. I mean, there are people who explicitly believe in teleology mm-hmm. in nature. They think that nature is teleological.
Wow.
For example,
those people probably are not scientists.
Well, for example, Michael Egner, right? My old friend, the creationist neurosurgeon. No, he explicitly says there is teleology in nature. That's it. He's the creationist neurosurgeon I talk about all the time. Who comments on my blog? And it's basically intelligent design. Intelligent design is teleology, right?
Right.
It's like that these structures were actually designed to have the function that they have.
Flagellum.
But there are those who think that even outside of the context of strictly Christian creationism, that nature is intelligent. Right. And that because there's this inherent, that's a very Eastern kind of philosophy, that because nature is intelligent, there is teleology in nature, because that intelligence can create things because it's needed, because it's necessary. Deepak Chopra is teleological massively. If you read what he has to say, like, yeah, you need something, nature creates it for you, you know? It's like the universal consciousness, which leads me to my news item, the first news item. There was a study published recently on transcendental meditation. I don't think we've talked a lot about
that's
transcendental meditation. Oh, yeah.
Hotter than ever.
Yeah. Or TM. I will say TM from now on because it's a lot easier. So this study is just, I mean, it's beautiful. It is a beautiful example of the frequentist fallacy, by which I mean, you know, doing p-value statistics and then because you find a statistically significant correlation, you say that the phenomenon that you're looking at is real, but without any consideration to other possible explanations or to
plausibility
or mechanism or anything. It says, hey, the p-value is low. It's real, you know, which is of course a fallacy. It cannot conclude that. Perfect example of this. So it's really, really wonderful, wonderful pseudoscience. The name of the study is Field Effects of Consciousness and Reduction in U.S. Urban Murder Rates, Evaluation of a Prospective Quasi-Experiment. I love that, a quasi-experiment. It's not a real expert. It's just a quasi.
Yeah, to the uninitiated.
Semi,
that sounds cool.
Yeah.
That's a tech word, Steve.
So here's their hypothesis, which, you know, it's hard to know exactly when they came up with this hypothesis, but they said, if you get enough people to use TM and to focus their good vibrations, you know, out into the world, that when you reach a certain critical threshold, that people in general will be calm and there'll be less crime, less murder, people will be happier, whatever. People will quit smoking, okay. You know, whatever you want. Now, how many people, you may be asking, do you need?
How many?
7 billion people on the planet.
Well, hey, hold on, Evan. You're getting ahead of yourself. They're only talking about America. Apparently, the universal field of consciousness obeys political borders. Yes.
Exactly.
So the universal consciousness in America. It doesn't cross over to Canada or Mexico.
That's right. Alaska and Hawaii count.
But yes, but they, it's not just continental U.S. Alaska and Hawaii absolutely count because, hey.
And Guam.
And Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
So, actually, Guam does not count. Don't get crazy. So,
okay.
The number is the square root of 1%.
What? What is that even? What?
Yeah, exactly. Why is it the square root of 1%?
That's what I was just going to ask.
I'm glad it's not negative 1%, because then it would be imaginary.
Yeah, because that is a great example of numerology almost, right? That's numerology in pseudoscience. Nature is not base 10, right? There's nothing inherently base 10 about nature. We arbitrarily chose a base 10 system because we have 10 digits. That's it.
We're natural. We evolved in nature.
Yeah, but Steve's saying, I know, you're right. But Steve is saying more specifically that there isn't like a base 10 reoccurrence in nature that, you know, you could say it's not the atomic weight of X or, you know, all that.
Exactly.
I understand.
Yeah. There was no fundamental constant of nature that's an integer. That's like the Planck's constant is 6, you know, exactly. I mean, obviously, right. Math is internally logically consistent, so there may be some mathematical things that are, but in terms of like a natural phenomenon, like there's no reason why the universal field of consciousness would be, you know, reach its magical threshold at the square root of 1%. But
Or any other
specific number, but you know, if they say that they theoretically demonstrated, they came up with this number by some kind of theoretical nonsense. But here's what's interesting. Is that the number used to be 1%. Now, of course, 1% of 300 million people is about
3 million
people. That's a lot of people. But they never could get 3 million people to engage in TM at the same time.
Okay.
So then they said, oh, you know what? We were wrong. It's actually the square root of 1%. It's not 1%. Because then you only need, by their calculations, you only need 1,725 people. So
that's easy.
So they did that. So in January of 2007, they ticked over that magic number of 1,725. Sweet. So what they did is, okay, they looked at the murder rate from 2002 to 2006. Why? Mm-hmm. I don't know. They arbitrarily chose that time frame. Maybe, just maybe, they were p-hacking. Who knows? Then they compared that to the next interval, 2007 to 2010. Again, you know, these are, other than the two time frames being the same, these are totally arbitrary. And they found that there was a statistically significant decrease in the murder rate in the United States over that period of time. Therefore, it was due to the fact that they had 1,725 people engaging in good vibrations through TM. There you go. And
I can't argue with that.
So they claim this is like classic frequentist pseudoscience. So this is a quote from the study or the press release. They calculated that the probability that the reduced trend in murder rates could simply be due to chance was 1 in 10 million. Or 1 in a trillion.
Trillion.
So they were saying there's only a 1 in a trillion chance this was due to chance alone. Wrong. That's nonsense.
What?
Wow. How do you get to that?
Then they said,
they ruled out other
causes. Like it wasn't due to the economy or it wasn't due to these other factors. Yeah. Okay. So here's the reality. The reality is that in the United States, crime and murder rates have been dropping fairly steadily since the 1970s. And it's also true that there's no one factor that explains that. So this is a continuation of a trend that has been going on for the last 40 years, almost 50 years, and we already know it doesn't correlate with any one sociological trend like economy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there was a little, but you know, all long-term trends, if you zoom in to short-term, there's ups and downs.
Sure.
So there was a little plateau between 2000 and 2006, and then it resumed its previous decline. In fact, not as steep as it was at its most precipitous decline in the 90s is when it was really dropping. So, I mean, they're just looking at these long-term trends and then like arbitrarily taking two time frames and then saying that they're responsible for the decrease in the murder rate. It's ridiculous. But they crunch their numbers and it's a 1 in a trillion chance that this number, that this decrease was by chance alone, but it's just that's the trend in the crime rates. It was there before you reached your magical square root of 1%. So this is just this is pure p hacking, is what this is.
Where'd you even find this, Steve? I didn't see anything about this. I mean, did news outlets pick this
yeah,
up?
What? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. There was press releases. It was published in a journal. You know,
I looked at this study, and to me, that shit is especially egregious. It's scholarly pseudoscience.
Yeah.
You know, it's technical. There's big words. There's math. You know, it's easy for somebody who's not familiar with this stuff to look at it, if they even look at it, and conclude, well, you know, they seem to have really looked carefully and scientifically into this. You know, it has 81 references. You know, wow, they really must be onto something. To me, that is really – it's a little scarier than your normal crap pseudoscience out there, because it's like – it's easy to take it seriously because it looks like it's serious. Like, holy crap.
Bob, and that's the exact point that makes me think that they did it deliberately. They knew what they were doing.
Sure.
Oh, of course. They've been at this for decades. They've been at this for decades.
Nothing.
This is what they do. They think they could change the world with transcendental meditation. They're always ginning up these totally BS studies, you know, where they're just taking credit for any natural favorable trend in society, you know, presenting it as a study, but it's just nonsense. It's not really controlled in any way. And again, the arbitrariness of using the U.S. border, why the trend was not the same in Canada. Why would Alaska be affected but not Canada makes no sense whatsoever. Why is the number the population of the United States, not some other regional population or whatever? It doesn't make any physical sense. Yeah, it just is. It's magic. It has the features of magic. The numbers
that's
they use.
TM.
Until just a minute ago. When you actually said transcendental meditation again, I had completely forgotten what phenomenon had this effect.
Yeah, because it's irrelevant.
It's like just like fill in arbitrary thing here.
Yeah. No, and the thing is, anything could take credit for the decrease in crime and murder over the last 30 years.
That's right.
It's the introduction of genetically modified foods. It's our increasing vaccines.
Yeah, I'm going with
vaccines and GM foods.
It's Donald Trump.
It's fracking.
It's global warming. Global warming is making people less likely to kill each other.
Clearly.
It's the MP3 files, you know. Cell phone use is decreasing the murder rate. It's anything. So you guys remember that website about the correlation where you could create all these fake correlations?
Yeah, awesome.
That's what they're doing.
It's polished up an old
saying,
idea.
Like, there was a website where they tracked statistics on completely random things like the ticket sales at Nick Cage movies versus people that got into car accidents who were driving on the wrong side of the road, and they happened to track. Right,
yeah.
So the peaks and valleys happen to track, and then the comparison is like utterly ridiculous. And it's a great exercise in looking at data and going, man, you could make parallels like down to like the week on very zero related items just because they happen to have similar data structure or whatever, right?
Yeah, I love when they do that. Nothing brings it home like pairing two things that you just know are completely unrelated. That just like smacks you in the face with the reality of doing that shit.
Well, Bob, some of Nick Cage's movies are that bad where people are like, that's it, I'm driving the wrong way on the highway.
I can't take it anymore. What this is marketing.
Yeah.
It's just a means of advertising their brand. They're trying to get people to sign up for their university and all their other products, books, whatever else they're trying to sell.
Here's the other thing they do. They do studies of TM. And they look at physical outcomes like blood pressure. And guess what? When you spend a certain amount of time every day relaxing, your blood pressure goes down. Then they say transcendental meditation is associated with reduced blood pressure, where I say relaxing of any kind is associated with reduced blood pressure. But they never do that control. Right? It's always doing TM versus nothing. How about TM versus reading a book? I wonder if that has the same benefit.
Or a massage.
Yeah, just they never, but it's all, the point of it is to promote this religion, you know, of transcendental meditation, where they think that eventually you'll be able to fly, right? That's the yogic flying. That's all TM.
That is levitation.
Yogic flying.
Yeah. You sit in a lotus position and you start floating around the room.
That doesn't happen.
Currents?
Well, Carrie, what they would do is they would get in the lotus position, and in order to transition to true, you know, floating, flying, they would flex their legs and actually hop. So they would continually hop and hop. So what they would do is people would become actually pretty good at the hopping, which is clearly not flying. But if you took a picture, at the right time, you seem suspended in midair. And of course, pictures get spread around. Look at this guy's doing the yogic flying. It's like, no, he's just in mid hop. That's all.
That's amazing.
He's in mid hop.
He's mid hop.
Flying by any other definition. You
mid hop yogi. That's a good name for a punk rock band.
Mid-hop
yogi.
All right, Jay, I understand maybe, just maybe, they might have found, as I predicted, by the way, Planet Nine. Tell us about that.
Whoa. Okay, Nine. Well, Kara, have you ever heard of Plan Nine from outer space?
Plan Nine? Is that different from Planet Nine?
Well, it is. Yeah, that's a movie, arguably one of the worst/best movies ever made. But this has nothing to do with
right.
it.
Oh, okay. I would argue that the worst/best movie ever made was The Mist.
Which one?
Oh, I love that movie.
Which
There's
one?
Nothing worst about
M-Y-S-T?
It. I love The Mist.
It's horrible, and then it's amazing.
Wait.
The ending. The ending smacks you in the face.
Yeah,
the ending
okay,
is
that's
amazing.
Hard.
Yeah, that but was the whole movie is worthless. That, anyway, Plan Nine. I mean,
yeah,
Planet Nine.
Planet Nine. Yeah, I used to think that the movie Plan 9 was Planet 9, but no, it's Plan 9.
I thought so yes. as well.
Well, you learn something every time we do the show, Ev. Yeah, so we're talking about Planet 9 that might be in our solar system. Over at the Siding Spring Observatory at the Australian National University, they conducted a crowdsourcing Zooniverse Citizen Science Project. Don't worry, I'll explain. Here's how it went. For 3 days, 60,000 volunteers from around the world searched for an undiscovered planet in our solar system using data from the Siding Springs Sky Mapper telescope. And they were specifically looking for a possible ninth planet that's in our solar system. And they found four possible candidates. They also found 4 million other objects. Wow. I mean, four million. That's a lot.
Okay.
The reason the researchers are looking for another planet is that there's this gravitational evidence that exists. You know, they're seeing objects get drawn towards a source. This is very similar to, I believe, episode 2 of Star Wars, when that planet where they're cloning the clones was removed from the database. Yeah. Anybody? Okay.
Yes, and the children.
Yes,
and
I do
Yoda.
Hate those first three movies, but I will bring up some of the science that was in there. Anyway, so that's evidence that there's something there. We just can't see it. So we're looking at, you know, objects that are being affected by gravity, but we can't see the object that is creating the gravity. So they suspect that the planet is a Neptune-sized planet, and it's supposedly way past Pluto. Now, that makes it amazingly dim, because when you're that far away from the sun, you're not reflecting that much of the sun's light, and you know what? We can't see it. So it's
significantly out there from what I understand. Isn't it almost as far out as Pluto is from the sun?
No, they're saying it's way past Pluto.
Mm.
I understand that, but it's as far past Pluto as Pluto
is
from the sun.
Oh, I don't know.
Wow, that's really far.
That was my understanding.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, from what I read, they were just saying that it was way past, but that's interesting, Ev. I'd have to do some more reading to figure that one out. So it takes researchers, you know, years to sift through data that they're collecting. They're taking pictures, millions of pictures of outer space, you know, and it's not all being processed by a computer. They have to look at this stuff. You know, sometimes they have algorithms that will run and analyze things, but, you know, nothing beats today. We still have to rely on the human eye and our ability to recognize patterns and shifting patterns. We can do it better than anything, and we can do it very fast and efficiently. So what they're doing is they had these 60,000 people look at pictures. So here's what happens. You sign up real quick. It takes 2 seconds to create an account, and I did it, and it's pretty cool. I did everything I'm about to describe. They give you a quickie tutorial, but in essence, what they're doing is showing you, on average, about 4 different frames that are of the same place in space with a time lapse between them, right? So they're showing you quickly, you know, frame 1, frame 2, frame 3, frame 4, and you just have to look at it, and your eye will be attracted to the changes in each of these frames. And if it looks like a bunch of these samples that they let you look at, so if it looks like an orangey or red dot that moves from one point to another, that might very well be a planet. if it looks like a hazy, blurry white blob that moves from one place to the other, that could be, you know, maybe that's, you know, just a big asteroid or something that's moving around. And then they tell you all the things to avoid, right? So there are things that are stars. So mm-hmm. if you see like a, something that has rays coming off of it or whatever, that's a star, you know, don't flag it. And the way that you flag it is you click on the picture. It's very easy. And then like a bullseye shows up and that's it. So you could put a different bullseye on any object you want, on any frame that you want, any number of times, you know, just to help illustrate what you're seeing. So the researchers that will go in, they'll take a look at what you found, and they'll probably, with much more trained eyes, go in and quickly figure out what's worth it or what's not. So it's easy to use. I spent about, you know, a half an hour because I wanted to see, you know, would I find something or whatever. I flagged a lot of stuff. I found things that exactly matched what they said. If you see this, flag it. And I did.
That's awesome.
Cool, Jay.
I spent about 4 or 5 hours doing it over the last like month. I've been doing it, you know, a bit at a time. And yeah, it's actually pretty easy. The training phase is pretty good. And I flagged a bunch of stuff. And I don't think it turned out to be anything. I didn't see anything really juicy like, oh, that's got to be something. It was just more like more equivocal stuff. Yeah, so 60,000 people is a lot of people. And that they're just essentially crowdsourcing the screening phase. Could you imagine if you had to look through all of that, do the work of 60,000 people?
Yeah, Steve, that to me, that's the big takeaway here. People are saying that they have achieved 4 years of scientific analysis in under 3 days.
Yeah.
Nice. To me, that's just like, holy crap, they should try to orchestrate something like this like every few months if they can. That's amazing.
Well, Bob, the lead researcher, he said this was a success. Brad Tucker, you know, afterwards said that this whole experiment was real science. It was valuable. Even though these were untrained people, they were able to do things that the researchers themselves would have to do. And if you think about it, it's pretty much a waste of time for someone with one or more PhDs to be sitting there looking at pictures when, you know, we can help. And, you know, maybe my half hour added into the queue along with 60,000, 100,000, you know, hundreds of thousands of people could do this in their spare time for fun at lunch when you're at work, basically, you know, doing clickbait. You could do this and help science. I think it's awesome. So, Steve, please include the link to the in the Zooniverse Citizen Science Project. And I plan on jumping on here every once in a while. I'll give them some of my time. I'm really happy to help.
We'll help with the grunt work.
Yeah,
no problem.
I love these citizen science projects. There's other ones. There's the protein folding one. There's classifying galaxies. That one's actually a lot of fun. You get to look at a bunch of blobs and say, is it a spiral galaxy or an elliptical galaxy or a barred spiral? Yeah.
I think there's some like with like whale song too. There's some that aren't astronomy that are more like biological things.
It's a protein folding one. Yeah, but I haven't seen the whale song. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think there's a whale song too. Or maybe it's closed now, but at least there used to be a whale song one.
I'm sure we'll see more of those because it is absolutely a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's also good that people who are not scientists, right, but they're enthusiastic about science, they're science enthusiasts, can actually participate directly, not just be on the sidelines cheerleading science, but actually get their hands dirty and do something that actually contributes to real science. It's awesome. I love it.
It is awesome.
All right, Bob, tell us about this robot octopus thing.
So, robotic researchers announce and demonstrate a robot arm inspired by Cthulhu. Inspired by octopus tentacles to securely hold objects and protect people. So this is another bit of fascinating and effective technology inspired by nature. I love seeing that. This was created by the German industrial automation company Festo.
Yeah, I thought it was a Greek company called Tentacles.
nice one.
So what's it for, Bob?
Well, it's a manipulating arm, a robot for you know, robots manipulating and holding objects. So instead of a claw or even a five-fingered hand, you've got this thing. Why an octopus tentacle? Besides, it's really cool. The team said that the octopus is a fascinating creature as it has no skeleton and is made almost entirely of soft muscle. It is also extremely flexible and maneuverable. This not only means it can swim agilely in all directions, but also grip a wide range of objects in a form-fitting manner, which is kind of the critical thing right there. So I looked at, you know, octopus arms and tentacles, and they are quite fascinating. They are muscular hydrostats, which I had never really heard before.
Okay.
So basically, a muscular hydrostat is a biological manipulator using a complex arrangement of muscles without an underlying skeleton. So just a blob of meat that can move, no skeleton underneath. So another way to look at it, it's the complex movements are made using the muscles of the muscles in the tissue to redistribute hydrostatic tissue pressure. That's where the hydrostat comes in. So basically, it's muscle moving muscle. Who could think of other natural muscular hydrostats?
The tongue.
Tongue, very good, Jay. Elephant's trunk and sure. Medicinal leeches.
Ooh.
How does a robot analog work then? Well, the tentacle structure is made of soft silicone that's controlled pneumatically. So the compressed air is used to basically cause the tentacle to bend and wrap around objects, right? So if you send the air to a specific spot, it just kind of curls around and can hold on to whatever it's curling around. There's also a double row of soul-sucking suckers that go down to the tentacle. Wait, let me check my notes. Correction, there's no soul sucking, but there are suckers that go from the front to the back. So from the tip, they're tiny, and at the back of the tentacle arm, it's they're thicker, they're bigger suckers, and those big ones are actually they use a vacuum sucker, so it's actually actively sucking. Huh. Just not your soul. The suckers at the tip, they're just passive. They just suck if the surface is appropriate for sucking. So the result is a very solid grip. So then this kind of ties into what are the advantages? So I try to think of and find out what are all the advantages of using this thing. So first of all, the grip is soft and secure. At the same time, with the silicone, the wrapping around the movement and the suction. So those three things make it a very, a very kind of soft and secure grip, which is something that you don't see in robots too often. The design is also good for weirdly shaped objects. Picking up a box is one thing, but what if you're like picking up a pear or a pretzel or something unusual? Jamie Condoliff at MIT Technology Review said, "It's notable because grasping irregularly shaped and slippery items is an incredibly difficult task for most robots." So yeah, if you think about it, that would be difficult for robots given the conventional, hands or attachments that they typically have. Another advantage you might not really think of is safety. Robots are increasingly joining the assembly lines with humans. Typically, you think of these isolated industrial robots, kind of moving really fast and precisely and powerfully, kind of by themselves or in a cage. But now they're increasingly kind of integrating with people. And as you could imagine, one stupid move by a person on a warehouse floor, and this big heavy arm could swing around and basically knock your head off. If it doesn't kill you, it could really injure the crap out of you. So something that is based on silicone that's very soft that could give you, could give you a good whack and not, knock something off of your body. And if you don't have to have a cage around an industrial robot, that's another good thing because you're freeing up this valuable warehouse space or floor space that could be used for other things. So in the future, what's going on in the future? Festo is continuing to test this arm on various other platforms involving soft robotics. Actually, the major arm that this tentacle was attached to was based on an elephant's trunk. But we actually don't even have to wait for this to actually be used because it's being used right now or something very much like it. A Boston, Massachusetts-based company, Soft Robotics, actually already developed similar octopus-inspired grippers that uses fluid pressure. And there's no suckers because they've got, instead of one long tentacle, they've got kind of four separate small tentacle-like grippers, kind of like if you took your four fingers and made a circle of them, straightened them out and made a circle, and they just come together. The tips come together. And with it, they're very soft. I saw videos of those hands picking up, a bag of potato chips, pears, lots of different things, very softly, very gently, and very firmly enough. And they're actually using this in the warehouse to pick stuff off the conveyor belts and start packing them away. And they're working out very well. So this means, I think, we could eventually have Cthulhu-inspired robotic overlords instead of the Terminator, inspired ones. So you may eventually get your soul sucked, but at least you might be able to destroy them by popping them like a balloon.
What I find interesting is the idea of, when we're designing robots from the top down, there's no obligation to make them look humanoid. Right, we could optimize their design for whatever task we have for them Or if we want to have like an all-purpose robot that can go anywhere and do anything and engage in a lot of tasks, I don't think that if we were just following function and utility, I don't think we would settle on a human bipedal format. You know what I mean?
Makes why would we?
Crappy.
It's limiting.
It's very limiting. So what I wonder is, like, when this robotic technology is mature, like 500 years from now, what is like an optimal all-purpose robot going to look like? What is it going to turn out to be?
Yeah, it'll be some crazy chimera probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It will have 15 different tools and arms.
Yeah, but
all-purpose.
When you say all-purpose, I mean, I don't think you could say one specific kind of configuration is going to be optimal, because you said all-purpose. I think what it would eventually be, if it were all-purpose, it would be reconfigurable. So it would be something that would have soft components that could reconfigure to be optimal.
Swiss Army
dolls.
But wouldn't it be funny if the robot ended up being R2-D2?
Astromech droid.
Probably not. All right, Evan, we're hitting some common themes here this week. There's apparently Boeing is getting into the deep space game. Tell us about that.
They sure are, yeah. And this dates actually back to last summer when NASA announced it had teamed up with six different companies to develop deep space vehicles as part of its Next Step program. One of the six companies, as you said, Steve, is Boeing. And just the other day, they unveiled their concepts for the deep space gateway and transport systems that could help, that could help achieve NASA's goal of having
Stargate?
Not quite that, Bob. NASA's goal of having robust human space exploration from the moon to Mars. So multi-world sort of capabilities here. Boeing revealed the concepts of their deep space habitat and, of course, their transport vehicle. It will essentially establish a base that will be very close to the moon, and they'll use that also as a jumping off point in order to get to Mars. Now, the idea of establishing a foothold on or about the moon is something we've talked about many times on the show before as a reasonable and feasible means of getting to Mars. It comes as no surprise that this is the exact direction NASA and the supporting technology companies like Boeing are going about it. And when you think of Boeing, you know, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Airplanes.
Airplanes. Boeing 747, 777. We've all been in a Boeing aircraft. Anyone who's been on an airplane probably is familiar with that. But what you may not know is that Boeing is also synonymous with spacecraft already, satellites specifically. They have an entire class of satellite systems called the 702 class, and they've been developing these since 1995. There are right now over two dozen Boeing 702 class satellites that have achieved successful orbit, and there are a dozen or so more in production as we speak. So Boeing already has a foot in space, but now it's getting ready to take a much deeper plunge in the form of deep space getaway. So part of the project is not only the station that would essentially orbit the moon or close to the moon, it will serve as the base for the deep space transport vehicle. This is what will bring, obviously, the people to the space station and then eventually off to Mars. The transport system will have living quarters so spacefarers can endure the lengthy journey comfortably, hopefully, and very safely. Astronauts can either stay on board or send a lander once they reach Mars for surface missions. The transport vehicle and the gateway habitat will be powered by solar electric propulsion systems, which is the technology that NASA used for the Dawn spacecraft. NASA's using this technology for further missions. Everything is sort of heading in this direction. Now, solar electric propulsion, or SEP, uses solar energy from solar arrays converted into electricity. The electricity is then used to ionize and accelerate propellant to produce thrust. The technology could potentially increase spaceflight transportation fuel efficiency by 10 times over current chemical propulsion technology. That's according to NASA. And it could also more than double the thrust capability compared to current electric propulsion systems. Boeing says it plans to launch the habitat in four parts through NASA's Space Launch System rocket. It expects to start sending and assembling the gateway in cislunar space, which is space between the Earth and the Moon. As soon as the early 2020s, we are on the cusp. That's soon. We are on the cusp of this. We're on our way.
Yeah, this could be a good addition. I like, you know, we've talked before about the fact that we really need to flesh out sort of the Earth-Moon system infrastructure before we really can sustain, you know, like trips to Mars or certainly a colony on Mars. There's a lot of people who think that we really should be focusing on the moon for now.
I'm one of them. I just don't understand. Mars is great. We will get there, but damn, why go there without having Moonbase Alpha, you know, up and running, you know, so at least we get our stuff together, our shit together. You know, if worst case scenario on the moon, you know, somebody could be here in literally in a few days. Can you imagine being 6 months or more? It could be actually far worse if it's a bad time of the year. You could wait a year. I mean, it's like you are totally on your own. I just don't understand why people just don't want to really work on the moon and practice on the moon first before going to Mars. It makes no sense to me at all.
Now, Evan, I saw no discussion of protection from radiation in their habitat. Did you come across anything talking about that?
Not specifically, no. So I don't know that they've necessarily – well, they're not ready to talk about it yet, I suppose, is that how they're going to be dealing with. That's a big deal.
That's a big question.
It's a very, very big deal, obviously.
Anything deep space, you got to deal with radiation. That's your first, you know, order of business. Otherwise – you know, you're just sending astronauts up there to get cooked.
Right.
We've said that. We've mentioned that many, many times. If you don't have a plan, then I really don't even want to hear it because it's a death sentence. I mean, that months in space, the solar radiation and the gamma rays, the cosmic rays, forget it. You're toast. And the thing is, they don't have a plan. They're not talking about it because they don't have a viable plan. You know, if you want to get shielding would work great. But you know what it would cost to launch tons of shielding just for your ship? Water would do a great job, but that's heavy as hell too. There was some talk once about you of creating an artificial magnetosphere, which is actually a wonderful idea because that would do what the Earth does to save us.
Right, but there's no doubt they have to suss that out. You know, forget Mars until we just to the moon and back. We have to get that straightened away.
All right, Kara. You're going to give us the latest installment in our Death by Pseudoscience series.
So before I dive in, I want to ask you guys a pronunciation question. I actually looked it up and both are correct. But how do you guys pronounce the word T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C?
Turmeric.
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 You all say turmeric. Okay. Some people say turmeric. Also correct, apparently. I don't know what I say.
No, they're not.
Turmeric, I think I've heard.
Turmeric, I don't think is correct, but I could be wrong. But yeah, it looks like the accepted pronunciations that I found were turmeric, like T-O-O, even though it's spelled with an R, and turmeric. An article was published last week in Forbes by Britt Marie Hermes, a former naturopath turned skeptic, and of course, a speaker at this year's Nexus. Super excited.
Yeah.
And what she did in this article is she detailed the March 16th death of a San Diego woman named Jade Eric, who died of a heart attack after receiving an IV injection of turmeric.
She was.
The autopsy.
IV?
IV. The autopsy is not yet complete, but the medical examiner has ruled her death an accident, unfortunately. Who knows? That may change. The official cause, though, quote, anoxic encephalopathy due to prolonged resuscitated cardiopulmonary arrest due to adverse reaction to infused turmeric infusion. The medical examiner is ruling this a direct cause of the infusion. As of right now, they're calling it an accident, but the investigation is still going on, which is why we don't know the name yet of the likely naturopath who actually did the infusion. So let's back up a little bit for the uninitiated. Let's talk first about turmeric and then also about what do you call it, naturopathy or is it naturopathy?
It's naturopathy and naturopath.
And then naturopathic. Yeah. So it's just like psychopathy and psychopath. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So for the uninitiated, turmeric is an Indian spice. It's a main ingredient in many curries that, while tasty, and I do quite love it, has been touted to possess all manner of dubious healing properties. Most notably, you'll hear naturopaths claim that it's a powerful anti-inflammatory agent, which can treat pain, stomach, skin, liver, and gallbladder problems, arthritis, arthritis, fatigue, cancer, Alzheimer's, colitis, diabetes, blah, blah, blah.
Whatever ails you.
Yeah, whatever ails you. Jade Eric, who died as a result of this infusion. So she was treated with an IV infusion called curcumin. That's named after turmeric's main chemical constituent. And she was being treated for eczema. So she had an itchy skin reaction, and she was getting this naturopathic, quote, treatment, and died as a result of it. So on the NIH website for – this is a whole other rabbit hole that we're not going to go down right now. But yes, there is an NIH website dedicated to the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. They actually state that, quote, claims that curcuminoids found in turmeric help to reduce inflammation aren't supported by strong studies, end quote. So even their complementary and integrative health, quote unquote, website says themselves that there aren't strong studies supporting the use for these reasons. There are very few studies on the efficacy of turmeric at all. There are like two that were randomized. Everything else is not controlled. And there is a lot of garbage out there in dubious journals. And I recommend that you read Britt's Forbes article to read a little more and run down all those rabbit holes. Here's a little bit of background on naturopaths in California. If you graduate from a school accredited by the Council of Naturopathic Medical Education that offers a graduate degree of either Doctor of Naturopathy or Naturopathy or Doctor of Naturopathic Medicine, and you also pass a licensing exam that's administered by the North American Board of Naturopathic Examiners, you get to legally be called a doctor in the state of California.
Yeah, that's scary.
And see patients, yes. Naturopaths learn about things like intravenous hydrogen peroxide therapy, UV light therapy, intravenous UV light therapy, and intravenous ozone therapy. None of these things are backed by sound science. At least two out of three of these things have killed people. They're not FDA approved. They're actually illegal in many cases. And here's a good example. The FDA says themselves that ozone is a, quote, toxic gas with no known useful medical application in specific, adjunctive, or preventive therapy.
Yeah, but naturopaths operate in a different world, a world without evidence. You know, they don't.
Yeah, belief system.
They have their belief. Yeah, they just, they, it feels good. It's natural. You know, it doesn't matter that it's an intravenous drug, an intravenous dirty drug.
Yes.
You know, because it's.
Yeah. So in Britt's article, she actually attempts to find naturopaths in the San Diego area who offer this treatment, this IV turmeric therapy, like the one that killed Miss Eric. Since the medical examiner's investigation isn't complete, like I said before, it's still unknown who actually administered it. But she did find a few cases. Now, many naturopaths have actually spoken to the press following this case, defending the treatment, but distancing themselves from it at the same time and saying, oh, our clinic only offers turmeric in pill form. We don't do IV infusions, but there is utility. So some of those people, I will say by name, are Kristen Reese, Hadass Hillowitz, and Mark Stengler. They have all spoken out in the press saying that this is a valid treatment, but that you do have to be careful when you do it. And then saying, but we don't offer it. We only offer the pills. But Britt did find a few places that offer curcumin, like Live Natural Health, LIVV Natural Health, which charges $200 for a 1 hour infusion. But that's only after a $200 to $400 initial consultation and office visit. She also found another naturopath named Kim Kelly. He offers the infusions, saying in an article in Natural Awakenings magazine that, quote, curcumin has been used for thousands of years for culinary and medicinal reasons. People have used it to help with pain, inflammation, immune system, and cancer. Intravenous curcumin is absorbed better, faster, and can be given in much higher doses compared to taking it orally. Dangerous. Therefore, he didn't say that. He did say, therefore, the benefits usually can be seen much sooner. If you're suffering from pain, inflammation, or arthritis, this may be the right treatment for you. It's about a 1 hour drip and may require multiple treatments or maybe just one treatment, depending on each person.
That's
helpful.
Insanity.
Yeah, depending on your bank account.
Exactly. And here's a fun fact. He has since removed all references from his website. So even though there's an archived version of his website and this article in Natural Awakenings magazine, his website no longer shows that he offers these turmeric infusions.
Yeah, I wonder what happened.
He will duck and cover until the attention goes away and then go back to doing what he was doing.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, so scary. So one thing that Britt points out in her article, which I think is super important, is that the law that grants licensure to naturopathic doctors in California is set to expire on January 1st, 2018, unless the California legislature extends that date. So perhaps this awful, awful tragedy may stir up enough controversy and get enough eyeballs on this harmful practice that worried Californians like myself will go to their congresspeople and tell them not to extend the date of the Naturopathic Practice Act. That's what it's called. This would not repeal licenses that have already been issued, by the way, but it would halt new ones from going out under the guise of this Health Freedom Act. That's really the umbrella here. And to learn more about that, Britt links to an incredible article, actually, on science-based medicine by Jan Bellamy, and it's called California Legislature Should Repeal Naturopathic Licensing. So I definitely recommend that you Google that blog post and read all about it and read about exactly what those licensing laws are here in California.
Yeah, it's horrible. Not just California, too. And healthcare freedom movement has been causing a lot of mischief. You know, the idea is you could decide, you know, what kind of practitioner you want to see, which is just a euphemism for we want to eliminate the standard of care and, you know, having any kind of validity due to science and evidence so that we could do whatever the hell we want and not be held accountable for it.
And naturopaths have managed to like wiggle their way in, right? Because there's all these in complementary and integrative medicine and blah, 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 where it's like, oh, they can do this, but they can't actually say that they're there to treat the disease, but they're allowed to say this, but they can't say that. But naturopaths have really like wiggled their way in so that they, to somebody who doesn't know anybody, seem like legitimate medical practitioners.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah.
It's so scary. But they didn't go to medical school.
No,
they're
mean,
regulated
they went to,
by their
a
own
naturopathic
board.
School, but they learned pseudoscience, you know.
Exactly.
And Britt wrote a series of articles for science-based medicine where she talks about her naturopathic education, and it's scary. They learn nothing of value. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Yeah, so last week I played this noisy. Anybody?
I like
it's It's a parrot after watching lots of classic Star Trek.
It's definitely an electronic or like is it like a mass communication sound? Something to do with telephone or internet or airwaves?
It's the sound of it's a 3D printer head moving.
Oh, shit. That is what it sounds like.
I wish I had one of those.
To print
3D printers are very, they're very musical. They really are.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
Yeah, this was sent in by a listener named Kyle Hazagawa. Wow, that's a cool last name. He said that 3D printers use stepper motors to move the head in each axis. The sound of a single motor moving on one axis is pretty boring, but to make a curve, two motors precisely and quickly shift the head in a tiny step on two axes simultaneously, creating the unusual sound in this file. Pretty cool.
That's awesome.
So a lot of people guessed... lots of people. And
anybody who
cool,
regularly 3D prints, probably.
Yeah, if anybody has it.
It was a cool like litmus test to get an idea of how many people have been around a 3D printer or own one.
Right,
but, you know,
right.
I got a lot of emails, so I think a lot of people out there have heard that specific noise before.
They're very musical.
The winner was Jeremy Smith. He said, as much as this sounds like the bridge of an old school Star Trek starship, I think it's actually a 3D printer. He got it right. And then he named the model.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, he did. He said, in fact, it sounds remarkably like a Prusa i3 MK2.
What?
Gee whiz.
Well, was he right?
I just don't know.
Well,
we should ask the guy who submitted it.
Kyle will have to email me and tell me exactly what that one was.
Did he know the serial number range?
Yeah. Probably. Printed the 3D printer was built in the fall, late fall, in the rain season.
the wet season.
And it'll tell us what it was printing.
Yeah, oh, yeah. The guy did.
Yeah, right?
The guy
it was
did.
A tube. You said it was a tube, right?
Yeah, wait. One guy wrote in and said, I believe it's printing a tube.
Shut up.
Yes, because the heads have to move in a coordinated motion to do it. It's not just a horizontal
I guess.
Print.
The tone would be different.
Well,
right?
There was a pattern to the noises.
Bam, bam. So, okay, I got a couple more. So, wait, a couple of notable mentions. So, Jeff McLennan said that's a 3D printer, probably while printing a replica of a Star Trek shuttlecraft. Thank you. And then this next emailer, Joel Glenister. Joel Glenister said, "The sound is clearly a recording of Steve's brain trying to compute why Jay thinks sentient AI is around the corner."
Oh, no.
Now, here's an interesting thing. I'll predict from this is that in the near future, somebody is going to create a symphony of music based on the noises that 3D printers make. They'll be able to actually conduct or compose music.
But they'll compose it based on it. They'll have to design what it prints, and then that printing will cause it to sing. I've been to a 3D printing facility. Like, I've been to a bunch of makerspaces, but I've also been to just a 3D printing facility, and it is an interesting sound that fills the air.
Hmm. All right, what do you got for this week?
All right, guys, the new noisy this week. This was sent in by a listener named Ilya from Moscow.
Cool.
I got this one, I think, 3 or 4 weeks ago. I've been saving it, and this one is really fun. It's really cool.
I know what that is.
What is it?
It's an AI trying to pronounce Ilya's name.
Oh my god.
If that is a talking sea creature, I'm going to be really annoyed.
I know, right?
That was awesome. That's a top 10 sound. I'm sorry.
I know. All right, so I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did, and wait till I tell you what it is next week and how much fun I had with that. You can email me with an answer, a guess, or something cool that you heard at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right. We have an interesting email this week. This one comes from David Burney from Columbus, Ohio. And David writes, "I'm a longtime listener to SGU and love and respect the show, which is why I thought of you for my question. Today, I took my 27-month-old son to his pediatrician because of a persistent cough. As part of the treatment prescribed, she mentioned and listed Highlands Kids Cough and Cold Syrup. When I got home and Googled the Highland Syrup, I found that it's freaking homeopathy. My initial reaction to this is to phone them up and tell them how angry I am that they would be prescribing anything homeopathic in any way. I am seriously upset at them, and I want to tell them I won't ever be using them again and to request to transfer my son's files to a new pediatrician once I find one. I am seriously pissed. In fact, I'm wondering if there is a governing body or agency that I should call and let them know that a doctor is recommending homeopathy. On the other hand, my wife says that perhaps they just recommend that because parents feel better giving their kids something for a cough, and since cough syrup is not normally recommended for kids under 3, this is just a way to soothe the parents by having them spend money on water. I will mention that they have kept him up to date on his vaccinations. So my question to you is, am I being reasonable by telling them off and taking my business elsewhere? Is there a governing agency that would care about something like this, or should I just let it slide and not put too much thought into a recommendation?" That's a very good question, Dave. We get this a lot. I've also had this experience, meaning a physician that I'm seeing as a patient or family member of a patient recommending pseudoscience. And so I absolutely think it's perfectly reasonable for you to tell your pediatrician that you're very concerned about their recommendation of what is rank pseudoscience, that does not speak well of their scientific standards, and that you are going to seek a different pediatrician. I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think you should give that kind of feedback to physicians. They will listen to that. I'm not saying that they're going to change their mind, but they certainly need that feedback. And what happens too often, unfortunately, is that patients, if they're not happy with their physician, they just don't follow up with them. They just vanish. And so, like, as a physician, I don't know, does that mean they got better? Or does that mean they're not happy with me? I don't know.
Yeah.
So you're missing critical feedback. So I think it's always give that feedback to your physician so that goes in their database, right? If enough patients are like, "Hey, this is pseudoscience. What's up with that? I can't trust you now. I can't trust your medical judgment if you think that it's reasonable to recommend that I use pseudoscience." So I would absolutely tell that to the physician. I wouldn't be like furious when you're talking to them, because then they'll dismiss you as, unfortunately, the more passionate you are, the more easier it is to dismiss you. But if you're sort of calm and, but forceful, that I think will have the greatest impact. Like, just, I'm very serious about this. This is very upsetting. This is pure pseudoscience. You know, I want and expect my physicians to be science-based. This is unacceptable. I'm taking my business elsewhere. They absolutely need to hear that. Because again, if they are doing it just to placate parents or just for marketing or whatever, to be touchy-feely because they think it's benign, then they also need to hear the other side, that they're actually alienating probably the patients that they would value, you know, patients.
Well, yeah, it's just as wrong. Yeah. I mean, what his wife is positing may be true. There's kind of no way to know unless you talk to the physician, but pushing basically a placebo to calm the parents down is dangerous because you have to at least tell them. You have to say, if you wanted to give them something, give them a carrot. I don't know. Like, give them something else. Like, you can't give a kid a cough medicine. I get that. A parent might be like, well, I'm going to anyway, because, you know, and it's like, no, it's dangerous to give your kid cough medicine. But there's got to be something else that can empower a parent that might actually be useful.
Empower them, like, with knowledge. Explain to them
exactly.
that you shouldn't give cough syrup. Get them on your side. You know, patients sometimes need to understand, and physicians need to understand, that sometimes the best thing you could do is nothing. That not doing something is an option. And
yeah, that's true.
You have to weigh the risks versus benefits. If parents feel like they always need to do something, then you will endlessly be chasing that rather than just listen. No, this is going to resolve on its own. There's really nothing that you can do that's going to help it. And then anything you do is probably just going to hurt. So just ride it out. Just give them
some TLC.
Give them some TLC.
But is that right, typical, Steve?
Sure.
Yeah.
Was what typical?
Like, for a doctor to like, always have to have the next step when there isn't.
Oh,
one.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a huge pressure. That's why physicians overprescribe antibiotics, because parents demand it, and they feel like they're the customer. They got to give them something. They got to leave with
even
the prescription.
Even for viral infections.
Yeah. The last time I went into the doctor with a, you know, quote, bronchitis, she tried to, and this was not my regular physician. It was like at an urgent care, because I didn't have a physician yet. She gave me an inhaler. She wanted to give me a cough suppressant with codeine, which I turned down. She wanted to give me a steroid, which I turned down. And she gave me, an antibiotic. All four of those things.
Gee whiz.
For bronchitis.
Just, like, open the pharmacy.
That's what they do. It's what they do. And it
sucks. That's what some do. Yeah, but that's.
No, yeah, exactly. That's what some do.
That's a good red flag that's not a physician you want. So here's the thing, Jay. So yeah, it's always nice at the end of a visit to have some kind of plan with the patient, right? And no one wants to hear there's nothing to do, right? But there's always something you could tell the patient that is science-based that you probably should be talking about them anyway. So you could say, listen, it's really important to keep well hydrated. Make sure that you're monitoring their fluid intake, and you may want to give them some juice, not just water, so they get some calories if they're not eating very much because they have a sore throat or whatever. This will be soothing. This is how you soothe their symptoms. This is the kind of, you know, lozenges that you can take that are safe for kids. Yeah. You know, make sure they're sleeping well. You know, make sure that they're comfortable. And so this is, there's some things you could do to make their sleeping more comfortable so that they'll get some more sleep when they're sick. You know, the cough, maybe push nasal drips and make sure whatever. There's always something that you could talk about, even if it's just the simplest, just lifestyle factors. Just, and then that makes the parents feel like they have something to do and they're empowered. They're helping their kids. It's the kind of stuff that people like because it's all non-invasive, you know, lifestyle type of stuff they should be doing anyway. You don't have to go for the pseudoscience or the unnecessary prescriptions.
The fake drug, which as we've seen historically, sometimes those homeopathic tablets aren't homeopathic after all.
Yeah,
the
Highlands teething tablets have belladonna in them associated with deaths of infant deaths. So you can't assume that it's benign. Absolutely. Yeah, so you should be pissed, but just calmly tell off your pediatrician and take your visits elsewhere would be my recommendation, but it's obviously up to you. All right, but thank you, David. All right, everyone, well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. You guys ready for three regular news items?
Yes.
Yeah,
okay. Should be
fun. Okay, here we go. Item number one. A new review of research concludes that adults need significantly less sleep as they age. Item number two. In a series of studies, Japanese researchers demonstrate that children as young as 6 months old are attracted to the heroic acts of others. And item number three, a new DNA analysis finds that indigenous people living in the Pacific Northwest display genetic continuity with local populations for at least 10,000 years. Bob, go first.
Adults need significantly less sleep as they age. I'm not buying that, just flat out. I know probably as you get older, you get less. But I'm not sure you necessarily need less. Children, 6 months attracted to heroic acts. Huh, that's damn young. Seems too young, of course. So indigenous people living in the Pacific Northwest displayed genetic continuity would look 10,000 years. Genetic continuity. 10,000? Holy crap. I mean, I could see, depending on the culture, how long you've been there, I guess. Yeah, the one that's really rubbing me the wrong way is the sleep one. I'll say that is fiction.
Okay, Evan?
Reverse order. DNA analysis, indigenous people, Pacific Northwest. Okay, this one I can believe. I would think that what happened 10,000 years ago? When was the Bering Crossing accessible by people? It has something to do maybe with that, because I think that goes back roughly 10,000 if memory serves. So I think there's something to that. The Japanese researchers demonstrate children as young as 6 months attracted to heroic acts of others. Well, a 6 month human brain. I mean, really, what is it doing at that stage of life and attracted to heroic acts of others? Maybe it is attracted to the heroic acts, but I don't, maybe it's more of a generic sense of, I don't know, excitement or something more basic. But have they been able to really focus it in onto specifically a heroic act? I would think it would be a little more generic than that, so I'm not sure. But the sleep one, I think I'm going to agree with Bob. Significantly less sleep as they age? What are we talking about here? Significantly, you have to have 6-7 hours now, so what are we talking about? 4 hours of sleep? 5 hours? That would be, I suppose, a significant level, but I think that's too extreme. So I agree with Bob. I think the sleep one is the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I don't think you're only supposed to have 6 hours of sleep. I think it's supposed to be more than that. Could be wrong.
Well,
I think that, but I do think that you guys are right. I mean, I know that older people sleep less at night. That's common, right? Older people have a harder time staying asleep through the night. And it's quite common that your grandparents only do sleep 4 hours at night. But I think that they also nap all day like a cat. So I wouldn't be surprised if older people need more sleep, or the same amount. I don't know if they need significantly less. I just think they sleep less at night. Japanese researchers demonstrate that children as young as 6 months of old are attracted to the heroic acts of others. I don't know. That's so like esoteric. Like, sure. I don't know if that's cultural or if there's something in us, you know, that's somewhat innate. But I buy it. Doesn't seem that out of left field. Indigenous people living in the Pacific Northwest display genetic continuity with local people. Well, yeah, indigenous people are genetically similar to local people.
Meaning they've been there for 10,000 years. That's what that means.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I think Native Americans go back really, really, really far. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what migration patterns of Native Americans within the Americas are. But Native Americans, yeah, seem to be genetically similar to what Evan said, coming across the Bering, the crossing, that's where the strait is now. And I think that was like longer than that. I thought that was like 30,000 years ago. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were populations there for a really long time. So yeah, those two seem reasonable to me. I'm going to go with the team and say that the sleep study is the fiction.
And Jay.
Yeah, the DNA analysis one, I see nothing, no holes I can poke in that. The one about the Japanese researchers who, the thing about young children, like 6 months of age, being attracted to heroic acts. I mean, you would think out of the gate, you know, how could the kid recognize that? And, you know, how would it even know what a heroic act is? But after having kids myself, I was always surprised at how early they were able to do things. You know, you always just think, oh, you know, a kid has to be much older to do that. But my daughter's like, as an example, she's 19 months old. She can't talk yet. She speaks gibberish, but she understands almost everything my wife and I say. So anyway, I think, yeah, I think that one, there's probably science too. So I have to go with the group here and say that the sleep thing is BS.
All right. Ooh, look at that. These guys are all aligned.
Ooh, could be a sweep.
Well, all right, we'll get to that one. But I'll take these in reverse order as well, since you guys are all settled on number one. Number three, a new DNA analysis finds that indigenous people living in the Pacific Northwest display genetic continuity with local populations for at least 10,000 years. You all think that one is science, and that one is science. That one's very cool.
We knew it.
Yay.
Yeah, that's a cool one. So they were comparing the DNA of local populations in the Pacific Northwest with DNA analyzed from fossils, right? From people from over the course of the last 10,300 years. And they previously had published mitochondrial analysis, but mitochondria, because it's inherited only down the female line, that can change. Mitochondrial lines can die out even within a stable population. Because like if essentially all of the women who have that mitochondrial type don't have daughters, you know, they have only sons, then that kills that line, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
The continuity of the mitochondria, which is only down the female line, can end. But this was a DNA analysis of genomic DNA, which gives you more information. And they found that, the people living in the Pacific Northwest are descended from people who were living there 10,000 years ago, which does correlate probably with the most recent migration across the Bering Strait. Now, there were probably multiple migrations. So that was really the question. Had people come over multiple times? And was there any more recent migration? Are the people that are there now people that had gone elsewhere? You know, did they come from populations that had settled in other parts of North America? Like, nope, the people settled there and stayed there for 10,000 years. At least enough of them that their genetics are still floating around that part of North America. So pretty cool. All right, let's go to number two. In a series of studies, Japanese researchers demonstrate that children as young as 6 months old are attracted to heroic acts of others. You guys all think this is science, and this one is science.
Yay!
Okay.
Hey. So this is interesting. Yeah. I'm always a little cautious about the psychological studies because there's so many variables and there's so many ways to interpret what does it actually mean. But they did a pretty decent series of studies here. Again, especially with something as squirrely as psychology, no one study is going to be definitive. But what they did try to control for as many variables as they could. They actually were using like cartoons to illustrate the behavior. So they basically had these circles, like a yellow circle, a red circle, and a green circle, and they had eyes in them. So they, you know, the eyes is really all you need to think it's a person. And then they, without no words, they just had like they would play out a scenario. Like the red circle was harassing the yellow circle, and then the green circle was a bystander, and either the green circle did nothing or the green circle sort of interacted with them in a neutral way, or the green circle got between them and kept the red circle from harassing the yellow circle, right? Something like that. So those are the different scenarios. And then they would give the children an opportunity to select a toy, a three-dimensional physical toy that resembled one of the characters that they just saw in the video. And when the toy actually heroically intervened in the physical harassment or abuse or whatever that was happening between the other circles, the even 6-month-old infants were much more likely to select that as a toy than the other ones. They also tried to control Evan for like, are they just following something interesting that's happening? But they know they controlled for it with other sort of similar activity, but just not interpretable as being intervention or heroic. They also tracked the kid's gaze, and they weren't just picking the toy they looked at the most. So it wasn't just a matter of what they were paying attention to. So, you know, they made a decent attempt at least controlling for the most obvious variables. They also looked at children of different ages. And what's interesting is that at different ages, different types of moral reasoning seem to come into play. Again, we're inferring here, but so they said that even at 6 months, no, not earlier, but at 6 months, children show a preference towards and somebody who intervened over a bystander, right? But then, which Jay and Evan, you both brought up sort of the idea of, well, how does the kid really know what's happening? And the researchers talked about that. There's a lot of context and reasoning that has to go on here. The kids have to understand quite a bit to realize that, you know, that one character is doing something, you know, and is in some way playing out some kind of sense of justice, which is the hypothesis here is that a sense of justice is hardwired at a very young age. And, you know, we actually, because animals can have moral reasoning, right? Birds enact justice on each other or whatever. So even the 6-month-old has some sense of justice and morality that's sort of cooked in. And that's what they were trying to demonstrate. But so in one series of experiments, the bystander helps out, but it's by accident. In another video, the bystander helps out on purpose. At 6 months old, the infants do not distinguish those two scenarios. But at 9 months old, they do. They're only attracted to the bystander who seems to act with purpose, not by accident. And so that means that the inference there is that's when kids are developing their theory of mind, meaning they're starting to be able to reason about what other people are thinking. They can infer intent in other individuals. Where it's
that's
six
awesome.
Months,
that's
they
really,
can't,
really cool.
Yeah, they don't infer intent. It's just whatever happened. But they still know that was, you know, doing something was better than doing nothing. But yeah, but then at 9 months old, they say, yeah, but he meant to do something and this other guy didn't mean to do it. So that's cool how different these different modules are clicking in place. And Jay, you experienced that, right? When your kids grow up, you realize suddenly they could do something they couldn't do before, you know?
Yeah, and even deeper than that, the insights, you know,
yeah.
Just making a connection about reality where you knew just a month ago it wasn't there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it is true. I mean, again, I think parents probably universally have this experience that your kids understand a lot before they can express themselves. We tend to correlate what and how much you say with what's going on inside your head. But kids have a lot more going inside their head before they develop the language to express it.
Well, a dog can do that, and a dog never develops language.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's true. You know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. All of this means that a new review of research concludes that adults need significantly less sleep as they age. That one is totally bogus. That one's not true.
Yay.
But what the new review showed is that as people age, they get lower quality sleep, and that it hurts them. They actually, even if the people do get less sleep, but they still need the same amount of sleep. And as older people get less and less quality sleep, so care, like if they're napping during the day and having less sleep at night, they're not getting into the deep restorative stages of sleep because they're not going through a good full sleep architecture. And what the research shows is that this is related to impairments in memory, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, stroke, and Alzheimer's disease. That you know, lack of quality sleep is really a huge age-related risk factor, which to me is no surprise at all. I mean, you know, in the last one, that's one of those things that has changed a lot in my practice and my awareness in the last 10 years or so. I mean, not that we didn't know that sleep was important, but you know, there's a much higher recognition now of how comorbid it is with so many things. You know, like I treat a lot of migraine. I ask all my migraine patients about their sleep, and there's so much poor sleep in just even middle-aged, you know, patients. A lot of them have sleep apnea and don't know it, you know. So we like now it's routine to do sleep studies on any people who are not getting good quality sleep.
Oh, like you said that the study showed that older people are getting worse quality sleep, which could lead to X, Y, and Z. Did they look at all, or did they put in the literature review? Why is it? Because we've known this for a long time that old people don't sleep well. that they sleep for shorter amounts of time at night? Is it just, is it secondary to having bladder problems and having other sort of medical issues that cause them to wake up a lot?
Good question. So it's probably two things. One is, as you say, there's lots of things that will keep you up at night. You're gonna get back pain, you know, after a certain amount of time. You have to get up and pee. There's just a lot of physical things that interfere with sleep. But the other thing is that the sleep part of your brain just degenerates as we age.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
So it's just a neurological thing. It's just not as well. You know, the hardwiring for sleep is just not functioning as well as we age, unfortunately. So, and the other thing is that it's fine to use like sleep aids, but they won't necessarily improve your sleep quality. You know, just using a sedative to get one to fall asleep is helpful, but if you're not staying asleep and getting deep sleep, it's not really doing much for you. You know,
it could also make you feel way worse if you're on a sleep aid, but you're awake. It's like, oh, God. Yeah. I'm exhausted, but I can't sleep.
Oh, so from what you just said, Steve, there's really nothing that they can do.
Well, that's not true. I mean, there's sleep hygiene. You know, you could talk to people about how to optimize their sleep. If sleep onset is a problem, you can use strategies and also medication to help people fall. Sometimes once people fall asleep, they're good, but they just can't turn their mind off. So those are the people that really respond well to sedatives. There are other drugs that do put you through a natural sleep cycle, you know, some heavy hitter drugs that we can use. But
some people have apnea.
Yeah, a lot of people have sleep apnea, which means when you fall asleep, your muscle tone relaxes and that your throat closes over. And so you can't breathe. And so you have to struggle to breathe. And then you eventually like have a loud snoring breathe. That's why people who snore probably have sleep apnea. And then it wakes them up. But they don't remember it because it just sort of brings them into like the lighter stages of sleep, and then they drift off, and then 3 minutes later they wake themselves up again, and so they're sleeping all night, but they're never getting deep sleep.
Yeah, and you can just get a CPAP for that if you need it, and then like problem solved. Although I don't know how people sleep with CPAPs because they're loud.
Yeah, most people hate it. Most people hate it.
Yeah,
but you could use the CPAP, which is kind of a short term solution. But for some people, it turns out to be long term. You could lose weight; that almost always solves it. But that's really hard to do, especially if you're not sleeping and you're older. That's tough to do because lack of sleep. This is the vicious cycle. Lack of sleep causes obesity, which causes sleep apnea, which worsens your sleep, which causes obesity.
So what's happening? Your throat gets fat.
Basically. Too much flesh in there. You can do surgery. So some people do need surgery to open up, you know, the airway.
Ouch.
And also some people could do it just with positioning. You know, like it's only like, for example, when they're on their back that they get the apnea, but if they sleep on their side of their stomach, they're okay. If they prop themselves up or have a inclining bed or whatever, they're fine. So there's different strategies you can use. But
so we swept.
My dad
Steve.
Had that surgery.
You did. You did sweep me. It was a good job this week, guys.
Woohoo!
Good job. Steve.
Yeah.
You know, people that are wanting to go to Nexus this year, they shouldn't wait because the early bird registration ends very soon. Ooh. There's only 1 month left. Prices are going to increase by 20%. Because the board is mean. No, because we're encouraging you to buy early. So it's after May 5th. So workshops are almost sold out as well. So it's not too late to get in, but you know the numbers are starting to fill in. You know what? If you can't make the full conference, you could buy tickets to our James Randi evening event, which is on sale now, open to the public for ticket sales. So you could go to nexus.org, NECSS.org, to check it out.
Going to be a good year. All right, Evan, give me a quote.
This quote was submitted by a listener, Soren Ragsdale from London in the United Kingdom. Thank you, Soren. Appreciate it. And I like this one. Don't assume the end game. Focus on the process, follow the evidence, and don't distort analysis with an imagined conclusion. Ooh, sage advice from none other than Garry Kasparov.
Garry. Hmm.
Cool.
Garry Kasparov, chairman of the Human Rights Foundation, visiting fellow at Oxford, author, speaker, 13th world chess champion, of course, is how I know him. Yes. Thank you, Jay. Thank you. Appreciate that insert there.
I'm sorry.
I think, and I being a chess player, chess lover all my life. Anytime I can commingle chess with skepticism or a skeptical worldview, I'm a very happy camper. So I was very pleased to present this quote this week. And thank you,
Evan,
Soren.
Do you play?
Mm-hmm. I play. I play chess.
Are you good?
Yeah.
You want to beat me sometime online? We should do it. I'd love to
play. I'd be happy to. I'd be happy to play chess with anybody. Just right after tax season. Give me till April 18th. And then, hey, I'll play chess all night long.
You got it, brother.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ben. Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.